guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet, as we've done for lots of years. Main purpose of the TechNet is education. The curious radio amateurs come together on Sunday night and teach each other the wireless art and science, and quite a few other things concerning physics and astronomy and topics of interest to radio amateurs. The net is broken up into approximately three sections. The first section is where people who do have a question or a comment sign in with their call letters and their name, and we take them in order and try to handle their questions or comments. That's followed by Roy, AC2GS. Dr. Roy runs the physics and science section. And then it's followed by Paul, WS2N, with the space report. Let me drop. So try to remember to once every minute drop the carrier and wait for the four beeps. And try to wait for the four beeps before picking up your microphone so that the machine doesn't time out. So at this time, we're going to take chickens for somebody who's got a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps. K2RIW listening.
And so we go.
Rich recognized. Anyone else? We're looking for people who want to check into the TechNet because they do have a question or a comment. So please give me your call letters and name right now if you do have a question or a comment for the net. One of the things I will be asking for people to make a description of what they saw at the flea market today. Tell us about the big one that got away or the thing that you did buy. So once again, if you've got a question or a comment for the net, give me your call letters and name right now.
KC1SAN, Sam, comment.
Okay, we got you, Sam. Okay, so far we got Rich and Sam. Was there a third person trying to check in? Please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, I think I'm hearing a fairly weak Freddy, Mr. PBN. And when we do finally get to you a little bit later on, do you think you'll still be with us, Freddy? Go ahead. Okay, maybe more people will be checking in later. First person on the list was Rich, N2EO. Go right ahead, Rich, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, I'm surprised we don't have more people, because I have some important comments. I'm sure you're familiar with the Parity Act. I'm wondering why it's called that, and what people might want to know, the Parity Act is to allow ham radio operators to have antennas in, well, they're now restricted in co-ops, condos, that sort of thing. Let me go ahead and drop. Anyway, Dick, I've been doing research because it's important to me. Because I have to move, it's hard to find a place on Long Island where they don't have communities that do that, believe it or not. So I'm planning to pull up stakes. I'm selling a house, it's already on the market. I'm going to move upstate and buy a mobile home. This way I won't be bothered with this. Barry feels the same way. I think I want to know, what is the Parity Act? Why do they call it that? I understand a fellow from ARRL named Paul Lufanko is working on it, and so is N2FF, the Hudson Division Director. I wonder if it's in committee. bedding. It was past both houses. I want to give you the phone number for Congressman Peter King. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, up till now, the only thing we had that gives us a little bit of defense for homeowners associations and zoning boards and things that are restricting amateur radio antenna installations was the federal PRB one, Papa Radio Bravo Dash 1, which is a federal law, but kind of weakly worded, doesn't give a great deal of defense. Apparently, the Parity Act is going to, when it's established and enacted, is going to be giving us a lot more defense. Anybody on frequency who's got some information about the Parity Act, give me a call letters right now. KTRIW in the TechNet.
AC2GS.
Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, I mean, you could always talk to Perry King. I think he co-signed it, so he's already on board. The problem has been in the past that the Democratic senator from Florida, who's great friends with homeowners associations, have been blocking it in committee. So it's been blocked in committee in the Senate. It passed in the Congress, but you have to pass it in the Senate as well and get it signed by the president. So that's where the last I heard it was stuck. The Congress is going to try and do something strange and include the wording in a different bill and get that passed as a combination act. But at this point in time, that's the situation. I wouldn't put all my my eggs in one basket with this, though, because it was approved by some homeowners associations after the wording was changed, so it's open to interpretation. It's not a carte blanche. It's a little bit better than things might be right now, but I don't know how much better.
Let me try rewording something that you just said. I think you're saying it did pass the House, but not the Senate. You said Congress. I'm not sure, but I think Congress means House plus Senate. So I think it passed House, and it's now being held up in Senate. Is that roughly true, Roy? Go ahead.
It passed the House of Representatives.
Anyone have any further information or questions? Give me your call letters right now. And I know one of the people working very hard on this was our previous division director, Frank Fallon, N2FF. Give me a call letters if you got any further information. K2RIW. So that seems to be where it stands there, Rich. And it doesn't sound to me like we're going to have this in our favor tomorrow morning, so to speak. I'm a little worried from what I'm hearing that this thing could drag its feet for an awful long period of time. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. You know, I like to stay on Long Island, but everything is a homeowners association here. I have to move anyway because the taxes are killing me here. To give you an idea what's available for hams, serious hams that want to move and get away from nonsense, I'm researched. You can get 10 acres of cleared land around Monticello, that's in Sullivan County, for about $35,000. You can also get a mobile home, which I'm going to do, for $78,000. That is a double wide, 24 feet wide, 78 feet deep. A single wide is also 78 feet wide and 12 feet deep. They're very nice. I've been in them when a friend of mine and his wife were looking. They're very, very nice. So I'm really seriously thinking of that. You have to And with that much land, it's do what you want. As far as antennas. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there are a number of amateurs on Long Island who from time to time had conflicts with their local zoning board, homeowners associations, the CCNRs, I think they're called. The restrictions on antennas are sometimes awfully unreasonable because apparently people believe that they're an eyesore or that they're a source of television interference or a source of a radio frequency biohazard. I'm not quite sure all of the things they worry about, but because there's only one ham radio operator per 500 people in the general population, we are the oddballs. Because we amateurs spend most of our life talking to other amateurs and other technically oriented people, we make the mistake of thinking that, hams are everywhere. Well, only 0.2% of the population are ham radio operators, so we are the unusual ones, and therefore we're fairly easily misunderstood, and we have to try very hard to make sure you don't offend your neighbors. Let me drop. My impression is that almost no town has enforcement officers that go around looking for violations. They wait until somebody files a complaint. On top of that, your neighbor is somebody you're going to live next door to for the next 10, 20, or 30 years. And so, whether you're a ham radio operator or not, you ought to try awfully hard to treat your neighbor very kindly. Just because he drops some branches into your yard, so to speak, you can say, hey, it's my right, you've got to remove these. Don't insist on things like that. That's small potatoes, if you know what I mean. So, to get into an argument with your neighbor is kind of silly. It takes two people to get into an argument. If one person is always very friendly and the other one is not, that's not an argument. It doesn't blow up into one of these situations that get out of hand. You strongly offend your neighbor. Let me drop it.
375 down, Dick.
Okay, sure enough, I'm checking right now, and 375 is not there. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Eric, looks like the Selden repeater is not operating right now.
That was going to be my comment.
Give me a minute, Dick. Let me check it out. K2EJ. Roger, Dodger. And after that, I'm going to have a question for you a little bit later. We'll stand by while you fix that.
Keep talking. It's going to take a minute to boot the computer.
Okay. So, I'm strongly recommending that we amateurs recognize that in the eyes of the general public, we are the oddballs. We're the second-class citizens. You got to be super friendly with the neighbors for more than one reason. You can insist that all of your rights are going to be honored and nobody's going to mistreat you. You can insist on things like that if you want to. I recommend you don't, because it can become very expensive. The people who get involved with legal situations because of a disagreement with a neighbor, because of ham radio or other reasons, by the time you walk out of that court of law, you're going to be unhappy with the amount of money it costs you and the amount of satisfaction you don't often get, if you know what I mean. So, it does sound like there are nice ways of living with a mobile home where you get a lot more for your money. And if you're willing to live in areas outside of the New York City area, it becomes an awful lot cheaper. And Barry has, N2MB has been talking about moving to a more rural area for quite some time, but he hasn't done it yet. Over to you for any final comments on all of the above, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Well, I've been thinking to Barry about that. I propose that we buy a piece of land, like a 10-acre lot, and we put two mobile homes, one for him and his family, visitor was in this body from that room 65 that you guys took down. And when I asked him to put it up, he said, consider it done. Barry is a great person. Back to you, Dick. I guess that's it for me. And to him.
Yeah, that does sound like a plan. We're 10 acres of property and two mobile homes on it. Now, the two mobile homes could probably be 500 feet apart. And with the trees, you wouldn't even see each other if you didn't want to. But still, it'd be close enough that you'd be have to do a little bit of choosing which bands you operate on when to make sure you don't QRM each other. But that's one way of getting around. Barry would consider his mobile home up north. Maybe he would consider it a vacation home, a summer home, whereas I guess you're thinking of living there year-round. Got to also worry about what's the local snow like and the snow removal services. Although, since you don't travel on the road very much, that's not going to affect you. I'm checking right now, and Selden is not up yet. Looks like Eric is still booting Selden. And Sam, KC1SAM, he was going to tell us about Selden. Looks like he's done that. Let me turn it over to Sam, see if anything else is on his mind.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Okay, I'm hearing Selden. I'm in. Yeah, I guess I'll pick it up. Yeah, Rich, you move up there. You're going to have to get snow tires on that. Yeah, all I was going to say was 375 works, but it's not linked. And it's one of those rare days I can hit 850 and I can hear it pretty good. So I'm going to pass that info along. That's really about it. I'm just sitting back listening. So back over to you, Dick. Thanks.
What don't you understand about stand by a moment, please?
Repeater, time out.
Okay, we're going to stand by.
I DeLauto Connect 10 enabled.
Okay, you hearing 375 now?
I'm hearing 375 now, yes. With a little bit of delay.
Okay, let's get somebody to talk on there and make sure it's coming the other way.
Okay, somebody give us a transmission on the Selden repeater, 975-375. Please do it right now.
Low radio.
Okay, yeah, thank you, Joe. Looks to me like it's working both ways. That's what I heard, Eric. What did you hear?
No, I heard Joe. Okay. We're all set. Carry on.
Is that also the IRLP node repeater? KC2SHO in Los Alamos. I hear you guys now. Thank you.
Okay, KC2SHO. John, so you're hearing the IRLP now. I guess Selden and IRLP are linked together. In other words, if Selden is off, IRLP is also off. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Just give me a second to refresh this page. Okay, we got Selden and also Los Alamos, New Mexico.
By way of IRLP, yes, John, SHO, which is signed in. So, if Selden is down, that means the IRLP is also not operating. Is that the way it usually works, Eric?
No, actually, usually we don't use IRLP for Selden. We use the RF link. The RF link cuts that once in a while, and I haven't had the opportunity to go and fix it.
Well, I've got you here, Eric. I've noticed in the last couple of days that over-the-air television 9-1, 9-3, and 9-4 are no longer there. And 9-4 is one that I like to listen to with heroes and icons. Will play the old Star Trek for me. So where did they go? I've re-scanned my machine, and I can no longer find the material that was on those channels. So is this a permanent situation where 9-2 is there? But 9-1, 3, and 4 are gone. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
9-2 comes from RF-44. 9-1, 3, and 4 were off the air for 12 hours, Dick. They're on the air now.
They're transmitting. Also, CBS has been continuously operating from World Trade. The fact that you were seeing it 20 dB weaker last week, they were doing a little bit of testing, but that's it.
Okay, so 9-1, 3, and 4 are now back on the air. That's very good. I've also noticed that channel 48-1, 2, and 3 is gone, and channel 50-1 and 2 is gone. Any words on those, Eric? KE2EJ, KE2IW?
Not find me again. Let me see if I can pick them up.
Yeah, the ones that are advertised as channel 48-1, 2, and 3, and channel 50-1 and 2, they seem to be off the air over the last few days. Over to you, Eric. Joe, what's the latest with you? So, you noticed those particular channels off the air also, is what I think you're saying. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-H-U-R-I-W.
W-H-U-R-Y-Y. I notice everything, Dick. You should know that by now. I caught that the other day, too, trying to watch 9-4, and it was gone. So I took out my service monitor and looked, and the carrier was, funny thing was, the carrier was there, same RF level, but it had a noise on it that sounded like a trunk data continuously on that pilot carrier. And the TV signal meter, the S meter, was all the way up, the signal bar meter was all the way up to full, but the decoder said no signal, so something was wrong with the modulation pattern or something. They fixed it 12 hours later.
9-3, 9-4, they're there. On JN, which is 50. I think they moved. I'm trying to remember where they are. Well, give me another minute, I'll look it up.
RF-50, DT-50, DT-58, Dick, are probably on RF carrier 8. RF-8 from New Brunswick. You may get them, you may not. I don't get them all the time. I think they're both there.
Yeah, they seem to be gone for the last couple of days, although when I do get them, 50% of the time, they're very spotty, as if there's some other carrier present that's interfering with the reception of 50-1 and 50-2. And channel 48, 1, 2, and 3, dash 3 has got the Korean programming, Aring, I think it's right, A-R-I-R-I-R-N-G. So, have you ever watched 48, Joe? W-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W?
Oh, yeah, well, of course, when the transfer's on the air, I can aim my antenna at 340 degrees and get it almost all the time. I think the transfer's up Poughkeepsie someplace. But I think they're going off the air. If you look on the FCC website for that channel, they're going to piggyback off WWOR's transmitter in the city eventually.
Okay, so I think you're telling me also, Joe, that from your point of view right now, channel 50-1 and dash 2, 50 is there and operating normally. Is that what you're saying, Joe?
I think you're only going to find 50-1 and 58-1. Those are on RF channel 8 from New Brunswick. They're no longer broadcasting on RF 50 and RF... 43, I think those are off the air. And it's all coming off RF-8 from New Brunswick, or whatever the transmitter is near New Brunswick.
Do you have a way of seeing if they're there now? Because I'm not getting them, and I always do.
I don't pick up RF-8 all the time. It depends on conditions. I get it about 60% of the time, maybe a little more, but sometimes I don't get it.
No, I'm not getting it now, actually. What I should do is look and see what the transmitter's doing. I'm not getting 50 or 58, and I usually pick them both up.
The UHF counterparts are off the air. They've been off the air for several weeks now, many, many weeks.
Eric, is there a particular website I can go to that'll give me the latest information on as to which over-the-air channels are going down and coming back up as something else. Is there a way where I can get that latest information without without bothering you all the time? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Unfortunately, no. I can see the stuff that's at NJTV and WLAW and WNET. I can't see anybody else's transmitters. Simply because I'm at work and the stuff comes from us, so. Let me make a phone call. I will get back to you in a minute.
Dick, did I ever send you a link called dtv.org? Basically from the FCC. And that has like a mapping type of availability. Once you put a zip code in, it'll give you TV stations from a particular area. Did I ever send that link to you?
Maybe you did. Maybe I misplaced it. The link is deltatango.org. Is that what you just said?
Well, that's the header information as far as in the internet. That's for the shortcut name. I'll resend it again when I get it in another day or so. I'll turn my computer back on. I'll resend to the current link that I have. But if you put your zip code in, or zip code in any area of the United States, it'll show you a list of TV channels you can get from that zip code locality. How's that? Good enough for you?
Yes, apparently you did send it to me some time ago. I do remember looking at that and had some very nice information. Looks like I've misplaced it. Haven't used it in a long time. I'm going to have to re-find it. And I guess by you resending it to me, that'll end that problem. I thank you. Okay, let's see if Freddie is with us. I think it's WB2VBN. Over to you if you're there, Freddie. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, your signal is very noisy, Freddie. You're about 80% noise and 20% audio. Anything you could do to increase your signal strength would help. But if you've got a question, let's see if I can pull it through with my earphones. Mr. VBN, K2RIW.
I have an 8-foot whip antenna. An 8-foot whip antenna. I want to know, with an antenna tuner, can I tune into the Mars frequency?
Okay, 8-foot whip antenna, can you tune to the Mars frequency? No matter what size the antenna is, no matter what frequency you want to use it on, if you had an antenna tuner that's broad enough in range, you can force any length of antenna to operate on any frequency. So the real question is there enough tuning range to your particular antenna tuner? You've heard me say from time to time the infinitesimal dipole. In other words, just to give you an example, a full-size half-wave dipole in 80 meters would be 132 feet long, center-fed. You could make that piece of wire a very small fraction of that distance. And if you've got a wide enough tuning range on your tuner that you can force that antenna back into resonance, at least at that one frequency you want to operate on, it'll work. So any length whip, any length dipole can be used on any frequency you want if you've got the right kind of a tuning assembly connected to it. By way of the Brown and Woodward curves, let me drop. The Brown and Woodward curves, you've got them on those two websites. One website is the one by KC2NJI. It's called amateurradio.tangovictor. And also on LimarkTechNet.com. In each of those, you've got this K2RIW article about tuning dipoles to any frequency you want. Once you know the length of your piece of wire and you go to the charts, there's one chart that will tell you the resistive component, the other chart will tell you the reactive component that length of wire is going to give you on your favorite frequency. You know ahead of time exactly what the impedance of that wire is going to be. And therefore, there's another website that will help you design an antenna tuning network, an inductor and a capacitor of the right size that'll force all of that to give the right impedance match and give the right tuning on your frequency. So will an 8-foot whip work? Absolutely. Your next question is it going to be easy or hard to do? But if you're willing to invest the effort, the 8-foot whip could be used on any frequency you want. Over to you, Freddie. Mr. VBN, K2LIW.
Buy a cheap one. Which one would be good for me?
Okay, but those who might not have heard Freddie, he's asking what kind of an inexpensive antenna tuner should he buy that'll help him in all these situations. Anybody got a suggestion? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW.
K2FIU, is he buying new?
Well, George, give him both answers, both new and used. What do you recommend? Where should he go to buy it? Is it something he can get on eBay? Is there a particular brand name and model number he should look for? Over to you, George.
Thank you, Dick. K2FIU here. I hate to go in the direction with MFJ, but that's the most common wide-used tuner with good response, the 949E, MFJ 949 Echo. And that's about $150. It's a manual tuner. Not unless he's got a specific radio that can handle an auto-tuner. I don't like working auto-tuners. Generally not wide enough, and I'm used and versatile with a manual tuner, as quick as an auto tuner can bring it in. Let me let it drop. Something like that is good for about 300 watts and has a dummy load. Probably the most widely sold tuner, period. Manual tuner. Other than that, if you want to wait and look around for maybe a 250-watt, 300-watt Kenwood or Yaesu used manual tuner that's 20 or 30 years old, doesn't hurt. Doesn't hurt because it's manual, and they'll run anywhere about the same price as that new MFJ, KD2FIU.
Yeah, the MFJ 949 Echo. You said it's $150. I'm guessing that may be the brand new price. And if one of those appeared used, it could be probably a much nicer price. So I think you're saying that's a very popular one, manual tuner. And my impression is Freddie is not the kind of guy that's going to run 1,500 watts. I think he's more of a QRP person. So waiting for a high power version, I don't think he needs. So the $150 for the MFJ, that's probably the brand new price. Is that true, George? KD2FIU, K2IW.
Yeah, that's about the brand new price. $150, $159. I've seen them $149. That's the brand new price. And this line of tuners, manual tuners that I'm talking about, the Yaesu, even the Kenwoods, they're all 300 watts or lower. They're not high power tuners. Very, very versatile. Very, very versatile, wide range manual tuners. The MFJ, you could probably get $90 or $100 used. But you got to be careful. Look at the plates and see that there's not white score marks on them, like somebody ran too much power through it. KD2FIU, over to you, Dick.
But even where those white scored marks where somebody ran high power and arced over that air variable capacitor. I bet you there's ways that that can be cleaned up, because the way the capacitor works, the surface doesn't have to be, you know, shiny and silver plated to do its job, as long as there's no chunks of steel wool in there, so to speak, in between the plates. So even one where it's been damaged, I'll bet you with the right kind of a wire brush that could be repaired. And that particular MFJ, I'm going to guess it's got a fairly wide tuning range. And one of the things to know is that if your particular antenna runs out of tuning range with your particular tuner, there is a solution to that without modifying the design of the antenna tuner. Let me drop. One of the things that I've mentioned a whole lot of times is that I wish manufacturers who manufacture an antenna tuner would give you a chart, which really is a Smith chart, and portions of the Smith chart are covered in. See, a Smith chart is that circular chart that every possible impedance of an antenna is there. You know, the resistor values go between zero and infinity, and the inductance values go between infinity inductance and infinity in capacitance. So all possible impedances is a dot somewhere on that chart. And as such, it would be real nice if an antenna tuner manufacturer would give you those charts, one chart for each ham band, and they would color in the portion of the chart where that antenna tuner will give you an ideal match. Because it's not just a circle in the center, if you know what I mean. It's a lopsided diagram as to what gets covered. And so if your particular antenna falls out of that region where your antenna tuner can handle it, let me drop it. By adding another length of coax cable between your antenna and the antenna tuner, will rotate the impedance on that Smith chart. That's what happens when you add extra cable length. You put a dot on the chart, which is the impedance of your antenna, and then for every length of cable you add, you're literally swinging a circle, a compass, so to speak, from the center of the chart, starting at that dot, and you're sweeping a circle. And so as you add cable length, your impedance is walking along that circle. So by adding the right length of cable between your persnickety antenna and your antenna tuner, you can force your crazy impedance to fall into the region where the antenna tuner will handle it. So you don't have to redesign the antenna tuner. Just add the right length of cable. I wonder if you've ever heard about that story before, George. KD2FIU, K2IW, the TechNet.
I've done it. I've added a 3/8 length, 10-meter tail onto an antenna that I had in the attic that I couldn't bring into proper impedance.
Well done. Out of curiosity, George, how did you find out about that technique? Because it seems to be only a few white-haired antenna engineers seem to know that particular one, if you know what I mean. How did you find out about it? Maybe you found an article somewhere in the Radio Amateurs Handbook, so to speak. Over to you, George.
I believe it was in one of my older, early 1960s books, and I wasn't a radio operator back then. I was in grammar school, but I have acquired some older, early 1960s books written by Stanley.
Yeah, it's one of the tricks in the bag of tricks that a good RF engineer knows about. You've got a length of cable. And in some cases, it almost doesn't matter what's the impedance of the cable. Just the length of cable will rotate your dot of impedance on the Smith chart to some other location. And 90-some-odd% of the time, the right length of cable will take your crazy antenna, which is outside of the tuning range of your antenna tuner, relocate the new impedance to a place where it's inside of the tuning range. So a broadband antenna tuner is a very handy device. And if it's reasonably well constructed, they run at very close to 100% efficiency. There's a ridiculous number of amateurs out there who believe an antenna tuner just takes the reflected power from the antenna because the antenna has got some standing wave ratio and takes the reflected power and throws it away. Absolutely not. It reuses that power, if you know what I mean. A well-shielded, well-designed antenna tuner is an almost lossless device, which, because our modern-day no-tune transmitters, let me drop them. The good news is they've got no tuning controls. The bad news is they've got no tuning range, if you know what I mean. If you don't have a 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio or better, the modern-day no-tune transmitters will not handle it. They go into a self-protect mode where they either turn off the transmitter or start cutting back the power output and so on to protect that final stage. But with an antenna tuner, that problem goes away. And an awful lot of guys think that they have to have an automatic antenna tuner. I don't quite agree. A manually operated antenna tuner does the job, and in some cases does the job better, because of the way an automatic antenna tuner works. There are certain impedance ranges where the thing goes into a search mode and never finds the right tuning, the automatic antenna tuner. Whereas a manual antenna tuner, the tuning and loading control operated by a skilled ham radio operator who knows what he's doing, you'll find that solution, if you know what I mean. Anybody have any further questions or comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, we had almost a perfect double. So one at a time. Come back, you guys. Who's ever trying to say something?
B2FIU for a final.
Okay, we'll take you first, George. Go ahead.
Working on that tail to tune the antenna at the station end. I had a inverted V that I installed in my attic for 10 meters. And it was kind of finicky. And it was just dancing all over the place. I put a voltage balun at the feed point of the antenna. I have 50 feet of 213 coax, which is fine for 10 meters. Brought it in with the trimming of the length of the antenna. I had a good SWR, but I had a poor impedance of about 30 ohms. I put the 3/8 wave 10 meter tail into the station itself, and it brought it to 48 ohms right there. So I had a tuned length radiator antenna element with 50 ohms of 213, great for the upper part of HF, and I brought it down from 32 ohms, to 48 ohms with that 3/8 inch tail of coax, but the coax was a different velocity factor. KD2FIU.
Now, there's something a little bit mysterious in what you just told us, George. Assuming your RG213 is 50 ohm coax, and I think you said you had 50 feet of it, and you added another 3/8 of a wavelength of 50 ohm coax, I'm assuming, with a different velocity factor, which really just changes electrical length. If you think it's 3 feet long physical, and it, because of the velocity factor, it may act like 4.5 feet, so to speak. But if you added 50 ohm cable, your 3/8 wavelength cable that you added, to a piece of cable that already is 50 ohms, in theory, that does not change the standing wave ratio. It changes the specifics of the impedance, yes, but does not change the standing wave ratio, because lots and lots of people think that there's a magic length of transmission line that will cancel standing wave ratio. And yes, they've done that experiment, and yes, it happens. The standing wave ratio changes substantially when they add or subtract extra length of cable. Let me drop. They see it happen, and therefore they're convinced that there's a magic length of cable that will cancel standing wave ratio. The answer is no. you'll see it happen because if you've got current flowing on the outside of the cable, then the outside of the transmission line is really part of the antenna. And when you change the length of that cable, you're changing the tuning of the antenna. But if it was a well-shielded system with a balanced impedance at the antenna itself, so if there's no common mode current on the cable, changing the length of the cable cannot change the standing wave ratio. KD2FIU, K2RIW.
No, okay, Dick, I didn't need to trim the SWR. I needed to control the impedance. That's why I put the tail on. I went from, a lower velocity cable to a higher velocity cable. The tail was a higher velocity. I needed to trim the impedance from 32 ohms, and I was able to bring it to 48 ohms. Trimming of the SWR was done with the element length of the inverted V in the attic. Once I brought the 50 feet of 213 lower velocity cable, 50 ohm, closer to the station, I didn't have the impedance I wanted. To bring it up, I used a 3/8 wave tail of a higher velocity cable and brought it up to 78. I used an 8X tail. As a matter of fact, I don't even have it installed anymore. But it brought it to like 47, 48, 49 ohms like that. And I realized that what I was reading was correct, absolutely correct, that I can control the impedance. While I was controlling the SWR by the length and trim of the radiating element itself.
The so-called Brown and Woodward curves for monopole-like antennas, in other words, a whip antenna above a ground plane, which really is half of a dipole, because a dipole is two ground plane antennas back-to-back, is one way of looking at it. By way of the Brown and Woodward curve, when you're looking at the resistive curve, you'll find out that by doing nothing but changing the length of the radiator, you can make the resistive component go from one ohm to thousands of ohms, just by choosing the length. However, in most cases, when you choose the length that you like to give you the resistive component you want, there's almost always going to be a reactive component left over. So when you were tuning the length of the radiator, you were really doing two things at once, changing the resistive component and changing the reactive component. That plus your change in coax transmission line length gave you the right combination. Impedance matching is a bit of a black art. There are people who have found all kinds of tricks that work for them, and they're not quite sure what all is going on. By way of those Brown and Woodward curves that are in those two websites I mentioned. And there's also another website. If you simply Google the word impedance matching and Berkeley. Berkeley has a website where you tell them the resistive component. You tell them the impedance of your device, whether it be antenna or whatever. So that's the load impedance. Let me drop. And you tell the impedance of the source, which in many cases is a 50-ohm transmitter, and you tell them what frequency you're operating at, and you press go, and Berkeley will give you, I think it's 15 separate solutions, and you choose the one that you like the most. It tells you exactly what inductor, how many microhenries, and exactly what capacitor, how many picofarads, will give you a perfect impedance match between those two devices. So Berkeley and impedance matching is a beautiful website. Over to you for any other comments, George. KD2FIU, K2RIW.
M3O, Dick. Okay, Dick, I want to put a final on this to let the net go here. It was an inverted V dipole, 120 degrees under the rafters in the attic. I put a voltage ballon further distribution, then brought it down with the cable and trimmed it with that tail at the station point that 3/8 tail, 10-meter 3/8 tail, with a different impedance of cable in order, a different velocity of cable to bring it the impedance in. The antenna SWR I was easily able to trim with the inverted V dipole, by the way, which really came out to somewhere around, not 4.68 divided by frequency in megahertz. It was really around 4.2 or 4.3 for 4230. It was much shorter than it came out to, but it trimmed, and I got it in to actually about a 1.3 to 1 over a good 500 kilohertz. And then I trimmed, I got the tail in at the station point with the different velocity 3/8 wave cable. I got the impedance to 48 ohms.
What's a 3/8 wave cable?
He's adding an extra piece of his transmission line, 3/8 of a wave long at the operating frequency, is what I think he's saying. Rich and Tui Yoga, right ahead with your question or comment.
Dick, first off, I admire George's knowledge on antennas. I never got into that. I always bought commercial. And, I wonder how George knew the impedance. He must have used an MFJ antenna analyzer. But I certainly admire his knowledge. I used to fix radios, you know. And for a while I did it for a living. I even started to get into stuffers now before I got sick. So that's all I want to say. If I could ask a question about rhombics, put me at the end of the list, please.
AC2GS.
Go ahead, Roy.
I'm a little curious. Is George talking about an extension on the coaxial transmission line, or is he talking about a tuning stub?
I think he's adding extra transmission line at the shack end of his transmission line. Is that true, George? Go ahead.
Yes. It's an extension of the transmission line at 3/8 wave of the antenna with a higher velocity factor. Specifically, a higher velocity factor is included.
Okay. Had you used a cable of some other velocity factor and you properly adjusted the length of that cable, wouldn't you have gotten the same result? Assuming it's 50-ohm cable and your transmission line is 50-ohm, the velocity factor just told you what length to make that. With a different velocity factor, you would just make that that tail, as you call it, a slightly different length. I don't think there's anything magic about that particular velocity factor to do the adjustment you wanted. That's an opinion on my part, George. Go ahead.
I was working on what formulas were coming out from twin lead to window line to ladder line experiments that were used in the past when they actually they have different velocity factors, and I was looking at as those velocity factors were increasing towards the speed of light, and different percentages that were used in experiments in the past. Then I'm looking at a 213 coax velocity factor, and I said, well, if I can come in with a better velocity factor of 10-15% of this, and then take the bandwidth of the frequency that I wanted to work this, and 10 meters, okay, so I'm going to go for 28-30 megahertz like that, and say, okay, well, the formula to increase it 15% is now going to be X amount of feet, and I tailed it on, and now I'm cutting and I'm crimping and I'm soldering and stuff like that. And when I went from 30 ohms to 48 ohms, I said I knew what I was doing.
Oh, was that you, Eric?
No, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I just got an email from somebody. Is the repeater saturating in the receiver, or do you got some headroom?
Okay, is the repeater saturating? I'm getting normal energy output from the repeater on 8.5, if that's what you're asking. Go ahead.
No, that's what I'm asking, because somebody in Danbury says that about 45 minutes into the TechNet, the signal drops, so I'm just looking to see if you see any difference in the output over time.
I'm seeing I'm getting full S-meter deflection that I normally get on this repeater, so it seems to be happy. Let me think. One of the things that Dr. Roy was just telling to us is that one of the things amateurs are not very familiar with is with a stub. In other words, if anywhere along the transmission line you put a T connector, and the straight through line is the transmission line going in and out of this T connector, and off to one side you put another length of coax, a coaxial stub of the right length, short circuited at the end or open circuited at the end, that is a beautiful impedance matching device when properly used. With that stub, you can synthesize almost any size inductor or any size capacitor in shunt that you desire by doing nothing but choosing the right length of that coax cable that comes off at right angles into that stub. So that stub placed in the right place along your transmission line, and the stub itself being the right length, can at least at one frequency give you an extremely high performance impedance matching device. Very small percentage of the amateurs are familiar with using stubs, but you Google the words impedance matching stub, I'm guaranteed there's going to be quite a number of articles on the internet that'll give you information along those lines. That's what I think you were indicating. Is that true, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, I might be what George was alluding to. It's a much more well-used method of impedance transformations than increasing the length and playing around with velocity factor. So I thought we had just kind of missed that part, that it was a stub.
KD2FIU.
George recognized. By way of the Berkeley impedance matching program, by way of the Down and Woodward, Brown and Woodward curves, by way of proper use of your antenna analyzer, finding out what is the real impedance at whatever position on your transmission line you care about, by way of using these tools, there's an awful lot of things that can be done. There's a lot of art and science to doing impedance matching. KD2FIU, K2RW, go ahead, George.
Thank you. And let me say this. When I was trying to improve the impedance on this antenna, I had coax jumpers that I was placing together and noticing the impedance differencing. I had an 8X 4-foot jumper. I had a 58U 3-foot jumper. It wasn't just the resistance in the cable that I was adding with the extra connectors, the barrel connectors, or anything like that. It wasn't until I actually sat down and calculated that I was going to take the 66% velocity factor cable at X length and bring in an X length of 78% velocity cable, it actually put it right together. And I realized that the recommendations, the formulation that I was looking at in this old book, working it with twin lead, ladder line to twin lead, window line, and ladder line, where there were recommendations.